Good afternoon. Thank you for joining us for today's presentation by Morten Schluter and Juma Ozkan, who will speak to us today on state regulation of religion, understanding Islam in the People's Republic of China. I'm Megan Phillips, your ICFRC co-director and host for today's program. As always, we thank our members, supporters, and interns for making these forums possible. I would also like to acknowledge our university and community supporters, the University of Iowa's international programs, the University of Iowa's Honors Program, the University of Iowa Public Policy Center, and the Stanley UI Foundation Support Organization for their financial support. I also thank City Channel 4 and UI Digital Libraries, as always, for helping us continue to make our programs available to online audiences. Today, we have another exciting online program. Following our speaker's presentation at about 1 p.m., we will have a 15-minute Q&A. Please submit your questions via the chat function on Zoom, which you can access through the chat box icon at the bottom of the Zoom screen. For those of you watching on Facebook, you can also submit your questions via comment, and we will do our best to monitor those as well. As a final reminder, I ask that you please keep your audio and video turned off for the duration of the presentation and do not interrupt the speaker. If you experience any technical difficulties, please refer to the Zoom support page for user guides and other support. With that, it is my pleasure to introduce Morten Schluter and Juma Ozkan. Morten Schluter is an associate professor and the chair of the Department of Religious Studies at the University of Iowa. His research is Chinese religions, mostly focused on Buddhism. Juma Ozkan is a doctoral candidate in the Department of Religious Studies at the University of Iowa, writing his dissertation tentatively titled as Contesting Sinicization and Defending Islam in Late Imperial China. Together, Schluter and Ozkan will explore how Islam's presence in China is as long as the history of Islam. Through commerce and diplomatic missions, Muslims traveled to and settled in China starting in the 7th century. And since then, rules and policies under different dynasties toward foreigners and ethnic minorities have shaped the lives of Muslims in China. This is also the case today, where the lives of Muslims under the People's Republic of China are significantly being affected by government regulations. This presentation, after giving some background about the history of Islam in China, will discuss the situation of Islam in the People's Republic of China with reference to legal documents on the regulation of religion, government reports, and news stories. Please join me in welcoming Morten Schluter and Juma Ozkan. And I will hand it off to you guys.
Okay, thank you very much, Megan. Let me just find my PowerPoint and share that, right? So I should be able to share screen and... Mm-hmm. Okay. Sorry, I still have too many things open here.
No problem.
Okay, here we go. Okay, so as Megan pointed out, my area is really Chinese Buddhism, so I'm not an expert in Islam, but we decided that I would give you a little bit of background on Islam in China, and Juma, who's my graduate student, he will then give you sort of the real part of the talk, which is focused on Islam and the political situation of Islam and other religions in China today. So, the first picture I have here is from the mosque in Xi'an, and as you can see, it's very Chinese looking, and basically mosques in China have all have looked very Chinese ever since the 14th century. Okay, so Muslims in China have traditionally called Islam Qingzhenzhao, which means the pure and true teaching. Now, what's very interesting, and few people really know this, that Islam may have come to China already at the time when the Prophet Muhammad was still alive. So already in the early 7th century, it seems Muslim traders and other Muslims came to China. One of them is supposed to have been the uncle of Muhammad, and he's supposed to have been buried at this mosque, which clearly, of course, is supposedly the first mosque in China. Now, that may be a little... it may be a little doubtful that it actually was started or was built in 627. But anyway, it was clearly founded very early. And you see this minaret, which is a sort of non-Chinese style. Now, over the centuries, many Muslims from the Arab world and elsewhere, traders mainly, came to China and settled there. And they came to a very significant economic impact and a big influence on Chinese commerce. So Muslim immigrants, they married Chinese women. And eventually, again in the 14th century, they took on Chinese surnames such as Ma, which is a Chinese surname, but it, in this context, it's basically short for Muhammad. And these Muslims became very well integrated into Chinese society. So today, many larger cities in China have Muslim neighborhoods with mosques and halal restaurants, which tend to be quite popular with non-Muslims. And here's a picture of some people running a restaurant. So this group of Muslims are known as the Hui. And so they are really indistinguishable from other Chinese. They do not have their own language. They speak whatever dialect of Chinese is spoken in the area where they live. And so, as I said, they are quite sort of well integrated into Chinese society, even though they're Muslims, which of course makes a significant difference. Now, there is another group of Muslims in China, and those are the people who are ethnic minorities who were Muslims before they, their areas, the lands where they live, came under Chinese control. And this actually did not really happen until the Qing Dynasty, and so really in the 18th century. Now, the by far largest and most well-known group of these Muslims are the Uyghurs in Xinjiang province. You can see it all the way out on the left side of this screen. There are also Kazakhs, Dongshan, and other smaller groups. Now, of course, the Uyghurs have been in the news quite a bit lately because of some Chinese policies against them as a minority, who are seen as potentially rebellious, basically. And so some rather unfortunate situations have occurred there. Now, these groups, the Uyghurs, and also these other smaller groups of Muslims, who are ethnic minorities, they don't look like other Chinese. They speak their own languages and have very different cultures from the mainstream sort of Han ethnic minority, ethnic sort of the Han ethnic group in China, which is sort of dominant group of Chinese. Now, traditionally, there's been very little direct contact between these groups of Muslims and the Hui. So we, when we talk about Islam in China, we really need to think of this as two fairly distinct groups. Okay, now finally, I'll give you a very brief overview, very, very brief overview of the history of sort of Islam and Muslims in China since the Tang Dynasty, when they first came to China and settled there. So by the time of the Song Dynasty, Hui Muslims dominated foreign trade, especially the trade that took the maritime trade. And the leader of that office, the state office for maritime trade supervision, was usually helped by a Muslim in that period. Now, under the Mongol Yuan Dynasty, the population of Muslims greatly expanded. Now, the Mongols were a non-Chinese people, the descendants of Genghis Khan, who basically conquered China. And they encouraged immigration from other areas, from many areas bordering China. And so quite a few people who were Muslims came to China that way. And the Yuan Dynasty often used non-Chinese so-called foreigners for high government positions. Now, during the Ming Dynasty, which is a Chinese dynasty, a number of Muslims actually held high office in the government and in the military bureaucracy, and especially famous and well-known is Zheng He, who was a famous admiral and explorer, and he came from a Muslim family. And there were many others too. However, at the same time, the Ming Dynasty also instituted policies to make Islam more Chinese. And so, for example, this was a time when Hui and other ethnic minorities took on Chinese names, and also the time when mosques started to look very Chinese, because the government basically wanted mosques to look like other Chinese buildings. They also made it more difficult for Chinese Muslims to interact with Muslims from other countries. Now, a final dynasty of the imperial era, the Qing Dynasty, ending in 1911. Like the Yuan, it was founded by non-Chinese people, in this case, the Manchu. The Manchu also often favored non-Chinese for high positions in government, but the Hui was grouped with the Han Chinese and were not given any special favors. Now, also during the Qing Dynasty in the 1750s, Xinjiang and other Western territories came over under Qing control, sort of got incorporated into the Qing Empire. And the ethnic population of Muslims in those areas came to be involved in several rebellions. They clearly saw the Chinese as invaders, and they tried to repel them. So the trouble in these areas have had a long history. Also, during the Qing Dynasty in the 18th century, there was a period of very sort of intense reflection among highly educated Hui Muslims about the position of Islam in China. And they produced a very important group of writings known as the Han Kitab. This is something Juma has studied. They were trying to understand Islam and sort of depict Islam in the context of Chinese traditional thought, especially Confucian thought, and showing how it was compatible, how Islam was really a kind of, logical extension of Confucian thought. So in spite of the success of many Muslims in China throughout Chinese history, and in spite of the fact that the Hui people through intermarriage came to look indistinguishable of other Chinese, they were not really foreigners per se, they were not different in substantial ways from other Chinese. Nevertheless, throughout Chinese history, Hui Muslims have often been grouped with other minorities and foreigners, and they've been regulated by special government agencies. So the government really never lost its suspicion that Hui people and of course other Muslims as well as other members of ethnic minorities were not always dependable and loyal subjects of the throne. And so this is just a little bit of background. I think will make it clearer to you to give you some background for understanding what Juma now is going to talk about. So I'll pass it over to Juma now. Thank you.
I am going to share my screen. First, I'd like to thank you for this invitation. And so Dr. Schluter introduced two major groups of Muslims in China, Uyghur Muslims and Hui Muslims. And this presentation fundamentally bases on Hui Muslims. But in the end, I will comment on the current status of Uyghur Muslims and the questions about internment camps. So there are important distinctions between the status of Uyghur Muslims and Hui Muslims in China. And the major distinction bases on the fact that Uyghur problem is a security issue for China. And there are anti-terrorism laws like Strike Hard campaign against violent terrorism approved in 2014, and numerous white papers on Xinjiang, which determines the status of, which determines how Uyghur practices their culture and religion. And let me give one example. So when I was visiting China in 2013 to 16, there were some restrictions for Uyghurs to fast during Ramadan in Xinjiang, but not that type of restrictions implemented on Hui Muslims. So in this presentation, I try to summarize regulation of religion in three phases under the People's Republic of China. And in particular, I try to address the possible reasons for changes to the repressed, which resulted in repressive regulation of religion in the last phase under the Xi Jinping leadership. And finally, I will briefly comment on the politicization of Uyghur issue by some politicians in the US, USA, and religious groups using this issue as a tool to attack China. Similarly, some Muslim countries some Muslim countries align with China, support its policies dealing with Muslims in China. So before the current leadership, there was an extensive scholarship and news reports and academic publication which discussed the revival of religion in China. Christianity significantly increased its followers and believers in China, and Islam has become more visible in public space in China, and other local Chinese religions, which were used to be considered as superstitious, started to be practiced in China. So I just have few examples of quotes from some scholarship. As you can see, the word, like the phrases, like an astounding revival, a rapid growth, explosion of religious activity. So this was the common understandings of the status of religion before the Xi Jinping leadership that I categorize as the second phase. But what happened after the Xi Jinping leadership, that direction the direction for the revival of religion has significantly changed. So what are the reasons which led to these changes, or what are the implications, like the implications of these changes on Muslims in particular? So what I mean by regulation of religion in three phases, you know, the People's Republic of China established by Mao Zedong, and when he won the battle with nationalist Kuomintang in 1949, and he established the People's Republic of China based on Marxist and Leninist ideas, and he also implemented the policies of these ideologies on religion. And in the second phase is the era of Deng Xiaoping and his legacy after the Cultural Revolution, which ended with the death of the Mao Zedong. A new era of Deng Xiaoping started, and there were many of the restrictions on religion loosened with this time period. And with the new leadership of Xi Jinping, we started seeing a very, very different era for religion. So let me say a few words about each time period. So first of all, we don't see a consistent policy of Mao Zedong when it comes to regulating religion. So in earlier times, when there was fight between nationalist and communist, the Communist Party under the leadership of Mao Zedong adopted a policy of allowing ethnic minorities to preserve their religions. So in this time period, Hui Muslims were considered non-Chinese who believe in Islam, rather than they were Muslim, they were Han Chinese who converted to Islam. With that mindset, their religion to Mao Zedong and his leadership meant that Hui people's culture, so it is wrong to attack their culture, which means religion. And especially during the Long March, when the communists fought with nationalist religions of ethnic minorities, such as Hui Islam with Hui Muslims and Tibetan Buddhisms, were respected to gain their followers' support. But that did not end the whole time period. And as I said in the beginning, his policy regarding religion wasn't consistent. And during the Great Leap Forward, this policy of respecting the institutions of ethnic minorities' religions was abandoned. And the nightmare happened during the Cultural Revolution, when Islamic practices such as prayer, fasting, circumcision, and remembrance of death were banned. And in the second phase, under the leadership of Deng Xiaoping, we saw the loosening of regulations on religion for the sake of building a harmonious society and using religion as a means to contribute state goals of economic development, and using religion as a means to provide philanthropy and social service to people. And there are numerous regulation which explains this phase's view of religion. And especially this document, the basic viewpoint and policy on the religious question during our country's socialist period, which was approved in 1982, and that determined the basic structure of the regulation of religion during this time period. And the following documents always based on this document. And I think this part that I'm going to read now really represents the heart of this document. So the basic policy of the party, the Communist Party, has adapted toward the religious question is that of respect for and protection of the freedom of religious belief. This is a long-term policy, one which must be continually carried out until that future time when religion will itself disappear. The basic logic behind this document, the party and the state does not need to intervene in internal regulation of religion, but the party and the state needs to improve the status of the economic and social problems of society, and religion will itself disappear. Now, that's an important distinction between the earlier time period and with the Deng Xiaoping leadership. And also there is a significant difference between the last phase under the Xi Jinping leadership. Because both under the Mao Zedong leadership and Xi Jinping leadership, we clearly see an interventionist approach to regulation of religion. So during this time period, there is one interesting circumstance, which was that some of the regulations have not really, some of the rulings which was mentioned in these documents were not implemented for the sake of maintaining social stability, economic development. So, for example, there was a recent incident in Ningxia which is a Hui autonomous region in northwestern China, in a village, in a small town, Wanzhou, local Muslims constructed a mosque, and 2 years after the construction, the local state decided to demolish the mosque because the construction violated the original plan. Local Muslims said that the local government knew the construction of the mosque and saw the mosque when it was constructed, but they said that why now, after 2 years, completed the construction of mosques. So that really speaks to implementation of some of the regulations which were on the paper, but the local state used its power not to implement or implement in a different way. So today, what we are seeing is a strict regulation of what is being written on the paper. So in this period, we also saw a significant degree of public presence of religion. For example, when you in China, Lanzhou Lamian is a restaurant which mostly run by Hui Muslims. So it's a noodle restaurant. When you visit this restaurant, you see that a lot of pictures of like Islamic sites in Saudi Arabia and Arabic signs, they explain the popularity of their dish with references to their religion. Basically, it's a clear sign of public propagation of religion. Like the Lanzhou Lamian restaurants are one of the like the is a kind of a McDonald's. It's not a, like the chain restaurant, but it's everywhere, and a lot of people like to go and quickly eat their meals, and they will see all of these big pictures of the mosques and explaining the their dishes with references to Islamic values. So these are legally not these are legally these are legally prohibited, but the local administration did not really intervene in these matters until the current leadership. So in this time period, we also saw the significant level of importation of Islamic movements outside of China to China, when Muslims went to different Muslim majority countries to study. They brought back different ideas. So that was not targeted in this phase, but now under the Xi Jinping leadership, it is not possible for someone who gets an education outside of China to become an ahong or imam or religious personnel in China. So now I like to give some visual. I like to share some visuals that I had taken when I was living in China, starting from 2013 to 2016. So this clearly shows that a significant number of young Muslims who come to mosques to learn Islam, and there wasn't any problem for Hui Muslims. And so this was when I visited a madrasa, an Islamic education center in Linxia in 2013, I met with the instructor who was teaching a commentary of the Quran in Arabic. So he was reading in Arabic and translating that to his students. And so these are like the students who do not necessarily want to become an imam or ahong, but they just want to learn their religion. So today, it's not possible for anyone who is under 18 to go to any religious site to learn religion. So again, so in 2013, this is a scene. And mosques in China mostly have a living quarters for students to stay for longer or shorter time period to learn the recitation of the Quran or basic Islamic beliefs and practices during summertime or in a year. So this was in Lanzhou in 2013 when Muslim students were waiting their imam and teacher before the night prayer in the Ramadan. So this is another interesting picture that a friend of mine took and shared it to me in 2015. I was in Linxia. I was invited for this graduation ceremony, but I had another appointment I couldn't make, but I asked my friend who was an instructor for this school and then shared this picture with me. So as you can see, they are kindergarten students and they had an intensive month during a summertime period to learn how to read the Quran. So now again, it's not possible. And these these are Arabic schools, were closed if they teach to under 18. So now with this new leadership, Xi Jinping became the president in 2012. And we started seeing some changes. This is an entrance of a mosque. And this is a mosque that I frequently visited when I attended Nanjing University. And when I was visiting this mosque, I saw the hanging of this new banner, reading "Study beautiful virtues and upright actions of Islamic prophets, strive to become a believer, loving their country and religion." So it's always emphasized that Muslims in China love their country before their religion. And when Xi Jinping visited a mosque in Ningxia, he also, there was a 1 minute video with him talking with Muslims. He said, we need Muslims, like the Hui people, who love their country and religion. So loving country always comes before religion. So, in the last phase with Xi Jinping, one of the important ways to understand all of these changes which happened starting with 2012, but 2012 with this new leadership, with this new leadership. So three people's thoughts made into the Chinese constitution. So Mao Zedong, Deng Xiaoping, and Xi Jinping. Xi Jinping has a different ways of ruling the China, and his ideas is, he presents himself in a very different way, and we can clearly see that on regulation of religion. So in the meeting of the Central United Front for Conference in 2015, he said religions should abide by socialist laws, law, socialist values, law, and Chinese customs. And he used this term, Zhongguohua, which can be translated as sinicization, which means basically making things in Chinese, or Chinafication can be another possible translation, but it can be also just Tinghua, listening to what the party says, not necessarily Confucian virtues or Chinese customs are the parameters, but what matters is to listen to party. And in National Religious World Conference in 2016, he emphasized this idea that religions should abide by socialism with Chinese characteristic theory, which basically means sinicization of religion. So we started seeing this phrase of sinicization of Islam and Christianity very frequently since after Xi Jinping introduced. And in 19th National Congress of the Communist Party in 2017, he again emphasized these ideas of changing the direction of religion into Chinese culture and Chinese values, plus socialist society. So basically, there are two important measures to make Chinese, make religions in Islam Chinese. First, they need to adapt to Chinese customs. Second, socialist values. So, and I particularly would like to talk about this five-year plan for sinicization of Islam. So in China, there is a government institution, which is Islamic Association of China, which operates under the United Front Work Department. And this Islamic Association of China adopted five-year plan to sinicize Islam, making Islam Chinese. So in this plan, what we are seeing is first, the Arabization of Islam is rejected, and clothing styles which do not adapt to Chinese styles should be rejected, and the construction of mosques which blindly emulates Arabic styles need to be replaced with Chinese styles, and the Quran needs to be Quran and the sayings of the Prophet needs to be interpreted in a way that adapts to Chinese society and socialist values. So what we are seeing here, the higher institute in China on Islam creates a plan to change the direction and orientation of Islam in a way that it fits into the standards of the party. So, for example, these four inclusions means like the national flag, the constitution, laws and regulations need to be an important part of mosque activities. And the core socialist values need to be taught in mosques and needs to be integrated into sermons. And again, the thought of Xi Jinping needs to be studied by the religious leaders, and most importantly, Muslims need to be grateful to the party, listen to the party, and work with the party, and to struggle to bring about the Chinese dream of the great revival of the Chinese people. So what are the practical implications of these policies? So in restaurants in China, there are signs, Arabic signs, showing that this is a halal, allowed restaurant, like the food. So, but all Arabic signs were removed on these restaurants because Arabic, you can see the changes happen on these entrances of the restaurants. So this is the one example. Another example, so on the right side, you can see a mosque, which in Beijo, and it was constructed with domes and minarets. And but the Chinese state and local government found this construction as non-Chinese and basically asked for the mosque administration to turn into a Chinese style. Otherwise, the local state would demolish the parts of the mosque which do not fit into Chinese characteristics. So there are other examples of intervening in the internal regulation of religion for Hui Muslims. So now I have 5 minutes or so. I'd like to briefly talk about Uyghurs. So again, so these are the five major instances that the Chinese government uses as a basis to depict the Uyghur issue as a terrorism. So Uyghur issue from the Chinese side is a problem of a security and terror issue. So Uyghurs did plot attacks to innocent people. And in one case in Beijing, three people were killed, and in Kunming rail station, 33 people were killed by Uyghurs. And based on these acts, the Chinese government started using an aggressive policies of limiting the activities of Uyghurs. And so many of the, I'm sure that you have heard what has been implemented on Uyghurs in the last few years. So basically Chinese government rationalized what they are doing by referring to terroristic activities some Uyghurs committed. So these are some of the measures that the Chinese government implemented. Like, for example, sending party members to the house of Uyghur families to making them spy what the Uyghur people were doing at home, if they were in any way see any mark of religion that would consider it as a suspicion, and those people later sent to internment camp to de-radicalize, de-extremificate. So these, they basically I've watched several interviews by local officials. They say that these Uyghurs are potentially these Uyghur people who have a potential to commit a crime, and before they commit a crime, we put them in an education camp to de-radicalize or eradicate their evil thoughts. So, but what they consider as evil thoughts can be very basic religious activity, like reading a Quran or just speaking Uyghur rather than Chinese. So in that sense, the state extensively is targeting to the religious and cultural practices. So this is my last slide. So sorry, and what I mean by the politicization of the topic. So in the last few years, I also taught the history of Christianity in China in two different institutions. So, and I saw the significant number of Christian groups and evangelical groups who extensively reported on Uyghur issue when they talk about Christianity in China, using like to attack China. They say, look, Uyghur, like the Chinese, are already bad people. They were doing a lot of bad things to Muslims, and it's not surprised that they were doing the bad things to Christians in China. And we see significant number of reports and in the Western media, and that those reports sometimes sometimes integrated into political messages. So the politicization of the topic might is not a solution to the problem, I think. Second of all, we don't see a strong response to China by Muslim majority countries. So for example, Organization of Islamic Council in 2019 wrote a report on the status of Muslims living as a minority. It's interesting, in that report in 2019, what it writes is it commends the efforts of People's Republic of China in providing care to its Muslim citizens. There is no way that this report talks about Uyghur issue or the demolition of mosques and anything else. So with that, I will end and happy to take your questions.
Okay, thank you so much, Juma. That was a very, very interesting program. I especially found the part interesting where they're talking about demolishing such beautiful buildings, these mosques. That's very shocking. So yes, now we will move on to the Q&A portion of the program. Please submit your questions via the chat function on Zoom, which you can access at the bottom of the Zoom screen. You can type your message there, and we will read it out loud for the speakers. While we wait for questions to come in, I would like to mention that we are in the process of lining up our online programs to kick off the fall semester. We will send out our usual email announcements about a week before each program, but please also check our website for the latest updates on future programs. If you have any comments or suggestions for future speakers or topics, please feel free to reach out to us by email with those suggestions. Additionally, I would like to take a moment to announce that we have officially launched our membership drive for the 2020-21 year. If you are currently a member, you will be receiving the usual renewal notice by mail in the next few days. However, if you are not a member but would like to become one, please email us at icfrc@icfrc.org. or visit our website for some information on how you can become a member. We would love to have you join. And with that, we can now begin Q&A. Let's see if we have any questions. Yes, okay, so I do see one question. This is from Bill Reisinger. He's on our board of directors for ICFRC. So he is asking, by all accounts, including yours, it seems like China is doing very bad things to the Uyghurs. Do you not agree that it is proper to criticize China?
I mean, yes, we should criticize China, but I think what I'm trying to caution is that there is, especially with regards to relationship between China and the United States, there is there are a lot of places that two countries compete with each other. This topic of Uyghur issue should not be politicized, should not be used as a means to attack to China. There are a lot of bad things happening to Uyghurs by the hands of the Chinese government, but I try to highlight the point that we should not use this Uyghur issue as only a tool being used for a certain time period.
Okay, great. So another question we have is from Amir, and he is asking, the Muslim countries which are supporting the Chinese government in the extermination of Muslims, is this due to the economic might of China and lack of U.S. involvement?
So with the Chinese state under the Xi Jinping leadership adopted this Belt and Road Initiative, which is a huge investment for infrastructure, basically Chinese government financing the construction of numerous projects, especially in developing or underdeveloped countries. And so for those countries who have such economic ties with China, they do not have got to speak out and speak against China. And Chinese government uses this as Chinese government also uses as a way to silence these Muslim majority countries. And plus, I think they do have a staged visits to these sites. Like they invite like the members of Muslim countries and they construct a staged visit to mosque and Muslim groups. Then they think that is not because in this is another important topic. In Muslim majority countries, they are also victim of the colonization, and there are intellectuals who say that we should not learn China through the mouth of the West. We should learn from Chinese rather than the means of the West, which also creates another problem Muslim countries are not very responsive to what's happening to China.
Okay, great. Yeah. So we have another question. This one's from Dave Wu, who's also on our board of directors. So this one is addressed to Morton. Do you see similar repression of the Buddhism adherents in China?
Mm-hmm. Oh, thank you. Yeah, that's a very interesting question. So there are basically five religions in China that are sort of approved by the state. So it's Islam and Buddhism and Taoism, and then two forms of Christianity, Catholic Christianity and Protestant Christianity. And so those are the approved religions. I actually think, interestingly, among those religions, Buddhism is probably the one that fares the best. Even though Buddhism, unlike the one among those five that's an indigenous Chinese religion, is Taoism. But Buddhism to the Chinese leadership seems like a very sort of civilized religion. People don't go all crazy and go into trances and stuff in Buddhism. It's not a religion that has really close relationships to foreign countries. Buddhism has been in China for 2,000 years, so it's very thoroughly sinicized and has been so for a long time. So in many ways, I think Buddhism is really favored. It seems to me that the Chinese sort of leadership feels that, okay, if you really have to be religious, be a Buddhist. That's probably the things we'll be the happiest about. So no, Buddhism really has not really suffered the same kind of restriction. That's not to say, though, it's not influenced by these policies. There is no full freedom of religion. I've heard from colleagues in China who, like me, teaches Buddhism at universities that they have to be very careful that they're not seen as sort of propagating Buddhism or anything like that. But stick very, very clearly to just history and sort of like a very neutral perspective. So
that's very interesting, actually. Okay, and then we have another question from Amna, who is one of our interns, and she would like to know, what is the best way to receive the latest updates and news about the treatment of the Uyghurs? It's hard to dissect bias of potential propaganda within the sources she's finding. So I think that's a really great question. I'm wondering too, how can we find information on this issue?
And there are a few prominent scholars on the field that I follow them on Twitter. So yes, especially, I don't want to generalize by, but like a significant number of like Uyghurs are being victimized and they use every means to propagate and raise awareness. And they sometimes use like in one case, like the beating which happened in Indonesia was presented as if that happened in China to an Uyghur. There were like the faked and pictures and videos were put into to the circulation of online circulation to raise awareness. So I try to, I mean, again, like there is one website which is operated by Darren Byler, which is a Living Otherwise. So he is an anthropologist on the topic. So I do follow that website and I might be hesitant to trust on like the Radio Free Asia on the topic, and for the same the purpose that I mentioned, but I think I find this Living Otherwise is a good website to follow what's happening.
Okay, great. Yes, thank you so much. And then it looks like our final comment is just simply, can you comment on the Falun Gong?
So I will turn it to the more Dr. Schulzer.
Okay, well, if you know more about it than I do, I'll be happy to let you speak. But anyway, I actually studied it some years ago a little bit because it was an interesting phenomenon. And Falun Gong actually incorporates a lot of Buddhist imagery, although also all sorts of elements from other religions. Now, the main problem with Falun Gong, I think, was that like other sort of new religions, so within religious studies, it's what we call a new religious movement. It was quite aggressive. It went very aggressively after its critics in China. And at some point, it's too complicated to get into the circumstances. They staged a huge, rather large demonstration in front of the Chinese leadership compound that's right next to the Forbidden City on the Tiananmen Square, the Heavenly Gate Square in China, so the central part of China. And so the leadership really saw this as a very big challenge, and so they clamped down on this quite hard. This is before, this is during the period when religion actually was quite, the policies against religion was quite liberal in China. But this is just too much that they challenged the leadership that way. And so that was really the main reason that was clamped down on so hard. Now, if you read a little bit about Falun Gong and learn about their teachings, it's hard to really be sympathetic, to be quite honest. Although I know there are some very dedicated Falun Gong practitioners right here in Iowa. But, the leader was saying things like, oh, don't go to a doctor if you're sick. Pray to me instead, and I can sort of remotely push out your illness. And so the Chinese leadership says a lot of people died because they didn't seek medical help for things like cancer and so on. And so I think that's actually true. Of course, it doesn't justify the kind of violent repression, but right now in China, Falun Gong has virtually no presence at all. At least if it's there, it's extremely underground because any sign of Falun Gong beliefs or that someone is a member of Falun Gong would immediately be clamped down on. So all Falun Gong activity happens outside of China now.
Okay, perfect. Thank you so much for answering all of those questions. I don't see any more, so we'll conclude. So just some final concluding remarks. I'd like to give a big thank you both to Morten and Juma for this wonderful presentation. Special shout out to Juma because he's joining us all the way from Turkey today. So thank you very much for doing that. And then I would also once again like to thank our sponsors for their generous support, and City Channel 4 and UI Digital Libraries for helping us make these programs available online. Morten and Juma, I want to let you and our audience know that even though we are conducting virtual programs for the time being, you will still be receiving our coveted ICFRC coffee mug. We'll just have to find a creative way to get it to you. Thank you again for presenting to us today. And to our viewing audience, thank you so much for joining us. And with that, we are adjourned.
Thank you very much, Megan. Thanks for great hosting. And thanks for everybody who was here.
Thank you for everybody for joining.
Great. Thanks. Bye, guys.
Bye.